Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is the Page Publishing Book Club. How you doing? I'm Alice Stockton Rossini. You know, so many first-time authors express frustration about how to draw attention to their books. Should they try and find an agent? Should they travel far and wide and try to get book signings in places with no connection to their book or to them? Should they go to book fairs? Should they call bookstores? They don't know what to do. So we begin with Linda Teeter, a one-time bookkeeper in Milford, Kansas, who's had some luck promoting her book, The Cold Dome, a story she says came from God.
It was in the middle of the night. I just woke up and there it was. Then when I would sit down to write, the words were there. I mean, it just kind of flowed.
Why do you think you were chosen?
I don't know. Maybe because I'm a willing vessel. I like to write. I like to share Jesus with anybody that'll listen. And what better way than to write something that is inspired by him, for him.
Okay, it's called The Cold Dome. It's set in the future, involves four teenagers.
Right, it's the sometime future. And the funny thing is I wrote this book back in the 80s, and some of the things that a group of people were trying to get away from is front and center now in our society. A group of Christians who were really struggling with the lifestyle going on around them and the things that they were supposed to be accepting or they would have to go to jail. They didn't. Society had fallen apart. There was no central government because everybody decided they had to do it their own way. Nobody could come into an agreement. So they got together, banded together their finances and their talents, and they built a dome over an unused army base in the Midwest that had storage underneath ground. And anybody could come in. They had to sign a covenant that they would obey the rules because there was no police department. It was set up on a kind of a pilgrims society. You did what the society wanted you to do, and you were willing to do that. Nobody needed to police you.
So you signed something to basically behave yourself.
Yeah, that you were going to self-govern yourself. Here's what's expected of you. And if you can do it, you're welcome. If you can't, please don't come in and disrupt because you will be asked to leave. There was one big door and they sealed that over when all the trucking was finished with, but there was one pedestrian door still available to anybody that still wanted to come in from the outside, but nobody ever did. It's like they forgot the dome was even there. And so they would use mainly solar power for their heat and cooling. They had huge battery packs. It was always maintained at a certain temperature, but suddenly, for no reason, the temperature started dropping. And it was noticeable, and they couldn't figure out why the heat was being lost. And so all the adults would talk about it. Well, the teenagers were invited into these meetings so they would learn how to self-govern. So one teenager and another family decided that they could make a name for themselves, make themselves rich and notable, and they would go and find the answer. So they left the dome in search of who they called the Eternal One. So the rest of the book is based on their adventures in the Badlands outside the dome, teachings that they had about their own personality. It's a book of friendship. They stuck together. They didn't always agree, but they did stick together, supported one another. And eventually they were able to achieve an answer, which they didn't know it at the time. They carried it back to the dome, and the end of the book is the answer. And I'm working on the sequel, Cold Dome Part 2. BAM invited me, Books A Million, invited me to their local store. I sold 12 there, which I was thrilled about. Take your book to a bookstore, and it's amazing how many you can sell. There's an Army base right here. It's called Fort Riley Military Reservation. And as a vendor, they invite me to go out and set up my table at the PX, and they're having a big car show, and they've already invited me to come out and set up my table at the car show.
That's awesome. How do they know that you wrote a book?
Well, I reached out and told them, and I said, could I sell my book? And the lady said, yes. And so she's been very, very supportive, as was BAM. And I've had two book signings at local restaurants. I was at a coffee shop and did a signing there. That was my very first one. And then a Baskin-Robbins ice cream store, who I know the lady very well, and she invited me to have a signing at her place. So I'm doing whatever I can do locally.
Yeah, and it sounds like you're off to a good start, Linda. Thank you. A retired addiction counselor, James Hendrickson, spent a decade writing his book entitled Addiction, What It Was Like, Conviction, What Happened, Redemption, What It's Like, A True Story.
But I've been in this all my life. I was in AA when I was 23 years old. I don't mention AA, by the way.
How come?
It's an anonymous kind of thing. So I just say 12-step program. I didn't get sober till I was 27. And now I'm sober 48 years. And my whole life has been involved in it. Once I quit drinking at 27, I started working the program. My book tells the whole story. And I come from a very hard place as a kid. So main reason I thought about writing the book was that it's just such a miracle what my life became from what it was. It's just beyond belief. It's just that good. And I worked as a counselor in the reform school in New Jersey for 2 years doing assessments on the kids in there, alcohol and drug assessments. And most of them had the problem I did. My mother and father were both alcoholics. They weren't mean or bad. They were just alcoholics. And the kids in the city, was a lot of them are the same, white or black. You know, they go through all kinds of things. They're poor. They're hungry. Their parents aren't taking care of them. Nobody's teaching them morals and values. None of that. So I thought that writing a book like that might encourage some kids, if they can manage to buy the book or read it, I thought it might encourage others that they can do it. So many times we blame our negativeness on somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, it is amazing that, you know, from the time you were a little kid, like you didn't have a roadmap. You didn't have anybody who cared about you. And what's amazing to me is that you got through this, that somehow you were able to find the strength to stop drinking and to turn your life around. What I don't understand is there are some people who they can't do it. And why, I mean, why is it mental illness? Is it, I don't know, character flaw? What, why?
I believe with some people, it is a mental issue where, you know, they just can't comprehend those things. But I also believe we don't have a self. Most of, you know, we're raised from the beginning without a self. It's father, mother, teacher, preacher, all that. And they tell us who we are, what we think, how we feel, everything. And then we get to be an adult and have to face life. And all we know is what they had. You know, if the family was really dysfunctional, we're in trouble, you know. And the reason I could do it is I guess my genetics, I'm not brilliant, but I'm smart enough to write a book. But that's another miracle. But you know, people just don't have the mental ability to do it. And you can't help that. But the best thing you can do with people like that is to love them and care about them and accept them the way they are and try to lead them and guide them and that kind of stuff. And that's what I did with most of them kids in the jail, you know. 80% of them were black, which didn't matter to me. But most of them, it's just a revolving door. And I think it's set up that way. I really do. They go steal a bicycle when they're a kid. Then after they steal the bike, they get on probation. And then when they're on probation, they smoke pot. And then they send them to the reform school. And then they get out of the reform school. They didn't have no treatment or nothing. They go back on the street, smoke pot again, violate parole, and go back to jail. And it just goes on and on and on.
Are there any programs to help them? Is there any kind of intervention? As a society, is there something we can do to help them?
The best thing I guess we could do is to just love them. You see some kids or some of them on the streets in the cities, and you just, if you have a heart, the compassion's amazing. And all you can do is, instead of being afraid of them, is try to love them. That's all you can do. And you know, try to guide them. They'll go on, do what they do. They might not even talk to you, but you got to be willing to risk communication with them. You know, you risk some kind of communication with a kid just sitting on a bench or on the street. You don't know what his life is, but it don't look good. And you just acknowledge them. That matters. You know, when I was 10 years old, a friend of mine, we were hitchhiking, and a friend of mine said, pray that we get a ride. I said, well, what do you mean? How do you do that? He said, just talk to God. I never stopped. I did. And it's in my book. No matter what I did or was doing, I prayed anyhow. If I was wrong, I prayed for God to be with me. And whatever God there was with me. You know, the thing is, in the back of my book, it's a chapter that's about the redemption. It's the last chapter in the book, and it's about the redemption and that kind of thing. And the idea is to share my experience, strength, and hope in all life lessons. You know, because I did a lot with family counseling and dysfunctional family stuff and addiction stuff. And I firmly believe, I don't care what your addiction is, you can work, it's the same. They're all different, but they're the same. And the dysfunction is where the issue is. So in that last thing about my redemption, I mentioned that, you know, the lessons of life and that kind of stuff. And, you know, so anyway, you might want to read that last, that one on the redemption.
Will do, James. Thanks. Ray Bannister writes what he knows in his book, An American Dream, having been born and raised in the Long Cane region of South Carolina, where many generations of Irish people settled.
The story is about an Irish family that got trapped in the Irish famine, and they had two sons, an 8-year-old daughter. It's a fictional story, but it has Oliver Cromwell, you know, he came into Ireland and took over a lot of the Irish land because he was with the British, and the British government supported that. And at that point in time, 80% of the Irish people, according to history, were all Catholic. And he made them denounce their Catholic belief and join the Church of England. So since they didn't do that, you know, he put a penal clause on them because they had confiscated the farmlands of Ireland. And so after the potato famine, there was starvation, and several million of them left on famine ships going to America. And they sailed across the Atlantic to Grocey Island, destination point for the Irish immigrants.
So we've got Andrew and Maddie O'Malley.
Yes.
And they left with their two teenage sons and their 6-year-old daughter named Rose.
Right, but just Rose left. The others stayed behind.
Oh, only Rose came over?
She was 8 years old when they boarded, and her mother encouraged her to go, or insisted maybe that she go to save her own life and have a life of her own. But Maddie O'Malley, Rose's mother, had a brother that had earlier migrated to the United States, and he married the sister of a guy who owned a plantation there, one of the biggest plantations in the South. And so Rose's mother sent her to America on a famine ship, and she was protected they had hired this Scottish sailor to look after her on the ship, and it paid, you know, ransom money to escort her to the United States. So they landed in Grocey Island, which is in Canada, and they were met there by this character who worked as a cotton broker for the McKeon Plantation. And he kept her in Boston until Rose's aunt could come to Boston to take her back to Long Cane. And then after that, you know, Rose grew up on this plantation, and she was financed by the McKeon Plantation. She was educated in private schools, and when she got old enough, she went to medical school and became a doctor. And then the Civil War had started, and get closer and closer to the South, to this big plantation house, and so Mr. McKeon, the plantation owner, got Rose to convert it into a hospital. He figured that it would be protected by the Union armies, but they wouldn't burn it or anything because it was a hospital. And so Rose, you know, then worked in this hospital all during the Civil War. And during the war, there was a guy from Boston who was a Union military officer, had got cut with a piece of shrapnel. And he had contracted gangrene. And so he was a soldier under General Sherman. And General Sherman couldn't get him back to a northern hospital. So he smuggled him in as a refugee into this hospital in the South that Rose O'Malley was now the head doctor there. And she had learned how to treat gangrene in school from a school in Charleston who had specialized in gangrene treatment. Well, as the story goes, you know, they, you know, after a while they become lovers or you know, mates, and eventually they married. But this is the story of Rose O'Malley from the time she left Ireland during the Irish potato famine, or was forced out, so she come to the United States and did that. But, you know, they eventually returned to Long Cane and bought land there after they married and lived there and established a residence there. Well, everything in the book is documented. It was came right straight out of history books, and it is documented history.
That's a great piece of historical fiction, Ray. Thank you. A one-time rock and roll singer and guitar player, Richard Young returns to his creative roots with The Mew Conspiracy, a book that reflects his love for sci-fi as a child.
Well, it's about an unprepared and peace-loving people suddenly finding themselves fighting a seemingly hopeless battle to prevent ruthless, murderous invaders from dominating the galaxy.
And where are they from?
Well, we don't know. It's sort of like a Star Wars type of thing, you know, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Mark Kesslin, he's a secret agent. And there's Lisha Armin, she's a secret agent too, and Mark's love interest. There's Commander Kern, who's in command of the defense. It's about how unpredictable events in life can be, and how the best of intentions can result in the worst of disasters, and that irony can come into play in shaping outcomes. You know, there's monsters in it, the ruthless beasts are trying to take over the galaxy and how they're trying to thwart them. There's a secret agent who's running for his life, trying to get to the neutral zone before the enemy catches up with him, and he starts the whole thing off. Because he's got the thing that the beasts are looking for. There's a thing called a Mew machine. That's where the Mew comes in. And this object makes the Mew machine work. And they're trying to find it because they need it. And I don't want to tell too much because there's certain things that the readers have to discover during the reading at particular times. Well, the Mew machine was how the beast got into this universe. Want to tell too much.
Is he running throughout the whole book from these beasts?
No.
And I take it it's a couple of books, right?
It's a 3-book set, because I figured 500 pages was as long as any novel needed to be, so I divided it into 3 parts.
Are there subplots going on? Are there other things going on as well?
Yeah, there's like different storylines, because there's a number of different characters and they all go off on their own directions, and then sometimes they cross paths and they're all working towards the same end.
Okay. What's going on with this society? You know, they want to ban all lethal weapons. They want to restrict intelligence gathering. You know, what's going on in this culture here?
Yeah, see, they were at odds with, I hate to call it a country because it's a section of the galaxy, so I made up a word called JALM, J-A-A-L-M. So the neighboring JALM was a belligerent race that they were having problems with. So they developed this neutral zone, and they had these mines in there that protect them from an invasion. So they figured now they don't have to worry, they can get away, do away with all the weapons and the secrecy and all that. But there was a secret group of people in the intelligence gathering division who saw that that was a dangerous thing, and they tried to keep a military going. And so finally it comes to the point where they have to defend themselves from these beasts.
All right, Richard, leave us hanging. Thank you. Retired outside of Nashville, Russell Pyle lost his wife a few years ago, but he keeps his life on track through sailing, music, and writing books like Vet's Reflections on Life.
I always kind of wanted to write even before I had anything to say, looking back on childhood. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I did 6 years in the Navy during the war, spent 4 years on a destroyer. And when I got out, I wound up in Seattle, Washington. And I got out, and it was a pretty smooth transition. I was at home where I was and ran out of time and money, as the song says. My parents were back here, and the home base was back here. So I kind of had to leave Seattle. And that kind of ended the world for me for a while. And I had some dark moments that winter, and I started writing stuff down, and it became poetry, and then later some songs and stuff like that. It's just been a place I like to sit down with fountain pen and paper. The book is basically a collection of that, and it starts basically when I'm really missing Seattle and want to get back. And it's a letter to a friend there that just reflecting on things, and I never mailed it. I realized, you know, that I had just put down some thoughts and there wasn't anywhere to go with it. But I collected just different moods and things that hit you. My wife put together the stuff that we had written as a family Christmas present one year. She was a writer too, and we did a lot with music and writing together over our 30 years together.
That's so sweet. Is there something you can share with me?
Yeah. One is a poem. It just kind of happened. Shadows fall upon the wall, memories in the night, dancing ghosts of blue-gray hue leap high on walls of white. The trees, they rustle in the wind, howling in the rain, rolling thunder shakes the windows, rattling the panes. Shutters crash and hinges groan. Demons of the night gain entrance down the chimney where logs are burning bright, and I can see the devils dancing in the firelight. I see them leaping in the flames that light my living room. They throw distorted images of deep foreboding gloom. Shadows dance across the walls, across my ceiling high. A narrow blue-white streak of lightning flashes across the sky. And every object in the room, ceiling to the floor, becomes a silver image as thunder shakes the door. The wind's more loudly howling as the storm is at its height. Somewhere close, the wailing of a lost soul in the night. A figure out my window and its arms outstretched to me. Pains my ears and chills my bones and shrieks of misery. It beats on my window and calls for me by name, bids me to rise and go to the place from whence it came. The figure screams and beckons me, the devil's at the door, and I to my bedchamber flee and quickly bar the door. Before I light the candle, I dare not take a breath. Through the window in the sky, I see the coach of death. Faceless driver, fire-eyed steeds descending from the sky, drives up to my carriage, and so tonight I die. Once dispatched, a coach without a soul cannot return. Whether you in heaven dwell or off in hell you burn, if those be unfitting and your life of partial worth, the soul is doomed to wander then forever on the earth. The souls you'll hear a wailing on stormy, rainy nights, then quickly get you into bed. Take care you leave no light, and think you very deeply on what from this page you borrow. With a banshee at your window be, you'll die before tomorrow. That's kind of a long meandering one. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, and I just felt writing something. It sounds more Halloween-y than anything else.
Wow. Yeah. Are you able to do like open mic nights where you are?
Yes, I do. I mostly play the fiddle, and I play guitar and sing. I play at a VFW here locally, and that's been a real great thing the last couple of years. And we have one down at a little local tavern called the Front Street Pub that is really receptive to that. And it's a connection. It's kind of an extension between the music and that. And about a third of the book is actually lyrics to songs. It can be read as a poem in the book, or it can be delivered as a song. And sometimes I do both of them.
Well, good for you, Russell. Thank you. Finally, Mark Schlossberg has made some very interesting observations over the years serving customers through his financial planning firm, MAS Financial Solutions, in New Hyde Park, New York. So he started writing them down, and next thing you know, he's got a book. It's called One Stop Financial Success. So one problem, you say, is that people tend to listen to other people instead of seeking advice from experts, right?
Well, they basically rely on friends. They rely on coworkers. You know, the coworker says, oh, you know, I put my money into this fund. Or they'll work with, you know, an advisor who will say, well, I think you need this portfolio mix, things of that nature. And it gets very confusing and people wind up making mistakes. And then you combine that with the government through the taxation and banks and corporation through, let's say, the 401ks, where with through their fees, they're taking money too. So basically, the book kind of outlines a very simple one-step process to save not only for retirement, but people forget about things like college funding, Medicaid planning, you know, to avoid, you know, a nursing home stay and losing your money that way to qualify for our government-sponsored Medicaid program. And I said to myself, you know what, I'm going to write down all these ideas, and then it became a book.
Don't you think a lot of people find themselves in a situation where they can barely make it through the week, let alone put money away for retirement?
Well, the problem is they are paying their bills, but they're not setting aside a proper amount out of what they receive. So basically what the book is detailing is how with one simple plan, with what little that you have, just follow the plan. You don't have to consult anybody. You just run your own race, as it were, with whatever little that you could put away, and it's flexible. You could always add more.
Okay, so give me some specifics. Like, you, for instance, you say turn your monthly mortgage payment into a monthly income payment. How do you do that?
As you're making your mortgage payment, the principal goes down. As you're following this type of plan, there comes a point where you do build up enough combined with the mortgage payments going down. You could take the money from your accumulated plan and very simply just pay off the mortgage. And usually that's about 15 to 20 years through the mortgage. So you're saving 10, maybe 15 years of mortgage payments. Now, here's the beautiful thing about that. Most people are paying mortgage payments in the thousands of dollars. Guess what? You're keeping that money because you're not giving it to the bank.
Okay, so pay for long-term care and critical illness expenses with someone else's money.
This one-step plan involves a certain asset. This asset, at certain points, can be sold to provide a large sum of money to do that so that you won't even need the Medicaid planning.
What is this asset?
The asset is through a permanent life insurance policy.
So you're saying to go out and buy a life insurance policy.
Use the asset that's going to be able to provide the funds needed for certain milestones in life, like the college funding, the Medicaid planning, and the retirement planning, by using this type of planning. And it's a one-step plan because you're putting in, you know, the funds every month.
The moral of the story is buy life insurance.
Use the life insurance in the planning. That's how we would like to phrase it.
All right, Mark. And that's it for this edition of the Page Publishing Book Club. Go to 710WOR.com to download the podcast. I'm Alice Stockton Rossini. I'll catch you next time.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.